Well, good morning, everyone. We have a good crowd here this morning. A lot of visitors with us. I want to first let you know that we really appreciate you coming out. We hope that you have gotten something out of the service so far, and hopefully over the next few minutes you'll find something in the lesson that will help you along your journey in our search for a way to live better with our Lord and Savior. We've been talking about 13 men who changed the world. Last week, I kind of did an overview, talked about all the apostles and a little bit about their nature and the ragtag group of people that they probably were. And we talked about Andrew as the first one. Now, when Greg was texting me back and forth to figure out what we were going to say or, you know, do for the blurbs that he sends out, which I really appreciate him doing, he was thinking 13 as in including Paul, and I was thinking 13 as in including Matthias. So, you know, as Benjamin this morning, we learned, well, there's really 14, so why did I pick 13? Well, I kind of did the cutoff, you know, at there at Acts 1 is where I was cutting off in the lists of the apostles. So we'll go with 13 for this series. But I have to warn you ahead of time, I'm probably not going to say a lot about some of them, people like Peter, because we hear about him all the time. And what I really want to do is help bring some of the others alive. I think too often we read past them and we don't think about the fact that when you look at this list of names, Simon, who is called Peter, Andrew, his brother, James, the son of Zebedee, John, his brother, Philip, Bartholomew, who's called Nathanael and John, and we're going to talk about him this morning, Thomas and Matthew and James, the son of Alphaeus, who is also called James the Less. And Thaddeus, Judas, another Judas there in the group, and Simon the Zealot, Judas Iscariot, and Matthias. We don't think of them as just normal people. But if you think about the fact that when Jesus called these men, they were just people. They were people like us. And I think sometimes we miss the fact that they had different characteristics. They all weren't just a perfect group. They had their flaws. They had their difference in character. And those are the kinds of things that I want to look at and see how they grew and how they became people who had an amazing impact on the world, even if they're not recorded necessarily in the book of Luke and the book of Acts, much beyond just their names in some cases. So we talked to Andrew last time, and we studied this verse a little bit in class this morning, but there's a couple things I wanted to point out about it. In Acts the first chapter, when they're picking out the replacement for Judas, and Peter lays down these qualifications that he has for what it means to be an apostle. And he says there that it's necessary that the men who have accompanied us all the time that the Lord Jesus went in and out among us. So that's a group that started, he says, with the baptism of John. All the way up until the time that Jesus died and taken up, one of those has to be a witness. Now, folks, there were two names that were put forward, but it sounds like there were a lot more than that that were qualified in that room. It says there were over 120 people there. And we know that a lot of people have been following Christ from the very beginning. And so when you think about that ragtag group and what did it take, I want to talk about two people this morning. We're going to talk about Philip. And in each case, when I've picked a person, I try to pick something that to me reminds me, it gives me a picture of the person. So I want to think about it this way. I'll give you my description of Philip first, and then we'll look at some passages where he finds up. But I think we probably all know people like Philip. Philip was a very practical man. He was not one to be much on the eclectic side. He wasn't one to go after rumors and things like that. Philip's the kind of guy that if you were trying to figure out what car you wanted to buy, and you went and talked to him and you said, I'm thinking about, you know, this car, this car, this car. He's not going to refer to the commercials that go, oh, what a feeling. You know? He's going to say, well, here's the features of this one and here's what they cost and here's the features of this one and here's the cost-benefit ratio. And he's going to think it through and he's going to quote his sources. You know, he's going to go to Edmunds and he's going to tell you what all his sources are. He's a practical kind of guy. And I think sometimes he has a hard time making that move forward in his service to a point of faith. but he gets there eventually. That's the part of Philip that's great. So he starts out as a real practical kind of person. Got to have every reason for everything. But where does he end up? Now, what do we know about him? Well, we know that he was from Bethsaida. Now, I put on the map, and it's really hard to see, probably with the home there, but we've got Philip and Andrew and Peter are all from this town of Bethsaida, which is up on the north side of the Sea of Galilee, kind of up in this area here. And that means that he's likely a fisherman. We don't know that. But there is something really interesting about him. You know, back then they put a lot of stock on names. We talked about this before when we talked about the names of God, a sermon I did a few weeks ago, about how names can sometimes be important. And when you look at that list of names, probably didn't cross your mind, Philip's the only Greek name in the list. All the others are kind of Jewish names. So you gotta wonder, what were his parents thinking? Can you imagine when they took him to the temple for his eighth day introduction into the Jewish world, and the rabbis are saying, and what is his name? And his parents say, Philip. And they're looking like, Philip? The only Philip they would have known that would have been famous at that time was the son of Herod the Great, who happened to be the tetrarch, the regional governor of the region where they lived there. It's like, was he named after him? Or maybe his father was Greek. We don't know. Maybe his father had some friends who, you know, he's named him after him, Philip, or that was a family name for them. But it's different. And so that tells me that he's got a little different background than perhaps some of the other apostles did in coming to this meeting here of this group that's going to be following Jesus. He appears four times in John. Now, we actually noticed him a little bit last week, but let's go back over to John, the first chapter, and let's take our first look at Philip in the Scriptures. Now, he appears in all of the lists of the apostles, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Acts. But outside of John, there's no further reference. So once again, we're thankful to John for bringing this man alive to us, for giving us some insight into what makes Philip tick. Now, in the earlier part of this chapter, we had talked last week about Andrew and Jesus, Andrew following Jesus and Jesus then talking to them, Andrew going and finding Peter. And so you remember we talked about Andrew kind of following John the Baptist and then John talking to Jesus and then he kind of went and followed Jesus, and Jesus was the one who had to turn around and kind of go, what you guys want? Well, Philip's not. It's Jesus who goes to Philip. Look at beginning in verse 43. The next day, this is after Peter and Andrew, he purposed to go into Galilee, and he found Philip, and Jesus said to him, follow me. And now Philip was from Bethsaida, a city of Andrew and Peter. And Philip found Nathanael and said to him, we have found him, of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. Nathanael said to him, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? And Philip said, come and see. We're going to stop there for now. We'll come back to the rest of the verses in a minute. But that's our first picture of Philip. I want you to notice a couple things about that. I mean, it's just a few lines there. But I think we can learn a few things. First of all, it's Jesus who comes to Philip. Philip seems to be maybe one of the only ones who kind of hesitated at first. Well, actually, that's Nathanael. But Philip is looking at this call here. And as he comes and approaches Jesus, something must have attracted him there. It doesn't tell us a time period, but it says he went and found his friend. Now, when he finds his friend, let's contrast the statement that Philip makes with the statement that Andrew makes when he goes to Peter. Andrew's statement was kind of like this. We have found the Messiah. He's excited. That's it. That's his statement to Peter. Now look at Philip's statement again. Nathanael, my friend, we have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote. Jesus of Nazareth, son of Joseph. I mean, where else did Moses write but in the law? And the prophets. But you see, there's a lot of oral tradition and history around that time too. So Philip here, I'm getting him confused. Philip here is making sure that he understands that this isn't some word of mouth. This isn't one of our traditions kinds of things. This is the person who was spoken of in the Law and the Prophets. I have references I can point to. And just to make sure that we're not misunderstanding this Jesus, who, by the way, had not really started his ministry yet. This is before his first miracle. Who is this Jesus? Well, he's the son of Joseph from Nazareth. Very detailed in what he's putting forward there. Now, I don't know about you, but when Nathanael kind of looks at him and says, can anything come out of Israel? We'll talk more about that in a minute. Philip's a very practical person. He doesn't sit there and try to argue with him. He doesn't sit there and try to persuade him. He says something simple. Come and see. Come find out. What's it going to hurt? You know, sometimes I think we, when we're trying to teach people, feel like we have to do everything right there, that we've got to be the one who can answer every question and do everything to try to convert someone. And Philip wasn't like that. Philip was very practical. He said, let's go find out. Come follow me. Come and see. And so when you look at somebody like that and the characteristics, you know anybody like that? They're careful. They may not know everything. But if you ask them a question, well, let's just go find the answer together. That was Philip. Practical. No reluctance implied there. But perhaps he might have had some difficulty with his faith. Look over in John the 6th chapter. John 6 and verse 1. This is the second time that we see Philip. We also looked at this parable last time, but we looked at it from the eyes of Andrew. I want to look at it from the eyes of Philip this time. After these things, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, or Tiberias, and a large crowd followed him, because they saw the signs which he was performing on those who were sick. And then Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was near, and therefore Jesus, lifting up his eyes and seeing that a large crowd was coming to him, said to Philip, where are we going to buy bread so that these may eat? This he said, testing him, for he himself knew what he was intending to do. And Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, for everyone to receive a little. Now that's an interesting point there, because it says, and Jesus was testing him. Why was he testing Philip? And what do you get out of the answer to understand the test? Yeah, I think part of the test here was Philip had been witnessing what was going on. Philip had been seeing the miracles. In fact, it says that these people were coming to Jesus because of these miracles, right? And when Jesus asked him a question and says, how are we going to feed this crowd? He asked the practical guy. He asked the go-to guy when you want to figure something out, right? And Philip stands up, and there's no reluctance in this. Philip goes, I've been given a challenge. And he looks out over the crowd, and he does some mental math. And then he's kind of looking over at Judas who's carrying the purse. And he's, you know, 6 months' wages wouldn't even give everybody here a little. He's defeated. Now, there's no reluctance in that. It's not like he's trying to get out of answering or something. He's looking at it and going, I don't know how to do this. That's really what he's saying. You've given me a challenge, Lord, and I don't know how to do it. You ever feel like that sometimes? You ever have times in your life when you've got challenges that maybe you don't know how to handle? And maybe you wonder what you should do. And part of the innate nature that we have is to stand up and say, I'll figure this out. I can do this, right? I can do it on my own. And that's kind of where Philip was, and that's why Jesus is testing him. Now, the next thing after that is Andrew, right? What does Andrew do? He goes, we got a little bit here, whatever it is, Jesus will figure it out. And he just gives the problem up to the Lord. Now, you think Philip learned something from that maybe, on that account? I think he did. I think that was part of the test, was so that Philip would learn. So here we have this practical man, this man who's having a little bit of a hard time with his faith in Jesus, even though he's seeing the miracles. But he gets this test. hasn't quite learned it all yet. Look in John the 12th chapter. We see him one more time over here. And once again, it's Philip interacting with Andrew. I have a feeling, just based on this, that Andrew was pretty much friends with everybody. You know, if you wanted something, Andrew was one of those quiet, in-the-background, go-to guys. And so here we have, in John, the 12th chapter, verse 20, there were some Greeks among those who were going up to worship at the feast. These then came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida of Galilee, and began to ask him, saying, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." And Philip came and told Andrew, and Andrew and Philip came and told Jesus. Now, why would the Greeks approach Philip? Well, Philip's the one with the Greek name. And so they're not sure. Jesus' ministry has been primarily to the Jews. He's been mostly going and teaching and preaching to those around Galilee. But others in the world are hearing about him. His fame is kind of spreading out here. And so here's some men who are Greek, and they want to talk to him. Now, you know, that's, at this point, Jesus is getting really close to rock star status, right? I mean, his triumphal entry into Jerusalem is very close. And at that point, he's got crowds out shouting for him. And so perhaps it's a little intimidating for these folks to try to want to talk to the master, to talk to this man who's being pretty controversial. So many things have been said about. So you go to Philip. And Philip is getting a little better here because he might know exactly what not know exactly what to do, but what does he do? I know a guy. I know a guy who can take care of this. And he says, come on. So they go to Andrew. But then notice it doesn't say that Andrew took them. It says Andrew and Philip took them. And so he went along and they introduced him to Jesus. So our practical guy is learning a bit, but he's still not quite there. Look over in John the 14th chapter. This is the upper room discourse. This is the night before Jesus is going to die. And he's got a lot to say to his disciples here. And he's trying to get them ready to understand that he is going to die. And beginning there in verse 7, he is in the middle of a talk, and we'll come back to the first part of that in another lesson, but he says, "If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. From now on, you know him and have seen him." And Philip said to him, "Lord, show us the Father, and it is enough for us." And Jesus said to him, "Have I been with you so long, and yet you have not come to know me, Philip? He who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, 'Show us the Father'?" Can you almost hear the disappointment there in Jesus' voice? The man that he'd tested just a short couple of years before, perhaps. Now coming up to the last minute. But I have this feeling. Philip wasn't the only one there. You know, a lot of times when there's a deep, fundamental question that somebody needs to ask, they're usually not the only person that has that question. Philip just happened to be the one who was practical enough to voice it and go, "Lord, just show us and it'll suffice. We'll be happy with that." Now, when you think about it, what had Jesus' whole life been and his 3 years of working and teaching with these disciples but showing them the Father? That's his answer, isn't it? When he comes back and he says, "Have I been with you this long and you still haven't seen?" And then just a short time later, his Lord dies. And 40 days after that, he winds up ascending into heaven. And Philip is one of those that we were talking about this morning who was standing on that hill. And the practical guy, I think, learned his faith. As a postscript, we don't know anything else about Philip. There's a lot of apocalyptic literature written in later centuries about the man. A lot of it's very fanciful, so I don't want to go into a lot of it here. But there are two works that have gotten a lot of circulation. One's called The Acts of Philip, and one's called The Acts of Philip and Helas. A reasonably reliable source comes from Hippolytus of Rome. His time period is around the 200 AD, kind of ballpark range for him. And he said that Philip preached in Phrygia, which is today modern-day Turkey, and was crucified in Hierapolis with his head downward in the time of Domitian and was buried there. All of the tradition that has come forward from early writings around that time period from scattered places seem to agree on at least these parts of the facts, that he did go out and he teached and he preached all over, but he went primarily up into that area of Turkey and again probably got some folks upset at him and wound up being crucified. Now, well, another thing that I've been doing here is, and I want to explain this a little bit this morning too, on the last picture when I put up the postscript, I'll try to show some of the signs and symbols that you may see if you're going around and you see other religious things. This is ancient iconography, symbols that a lot of people began to associate with the apostles. There's nothing special about them. I don't mean anything by that. But I just want you to be aware that people tried to put the stories in these pictures. And so for Philip, quite often what you'll see is a cross, meaning that he was crucified on it, as was his Lord, with a couple of pieces of bread. Do you know why that's there? Yeah, because of the 5,000, right? That test that he didn't quite pass well enough there. As a reminder that all of us have characteristics, just like Philip. But just like Philip, we can overcome them. We can learn, even as practical people, to put our faith and trust in God and put him first. Now, Philip had a friend, and we're just going to talk briefly about him, and that is Nathanael. Now, I've called Nathanael guileless and plain spoken. We know even less about Nathanael than we know about Philip. We do know that he was from Cana. Now, Cana happened to be the site of Jesus' first miracle when he was at the wedding feast. There is a tradition that is totally unverifiable that Nathanael was the butler that was there when that was going on. I think that might be a bit fanciful, but he was from that same town. Now, I want you to notice that Nazareth is just south of that. You've got the home of James down there, of Jesus. We've got Philip, Peter, and Andrew over in Bethsaida, and we've got Nathanael there in Cana. All those things are relatively close together. They're anywhere from 5 to 20 miles apart, depending on the route you take and that kind of thing. So it's possible that they would have known each other even in the early days before Jesus started his ministry. And we certainly know that they were part of that crew that was gathered with John the Baptist there as he was working down in Bethany beyond the Jordan, which is that kind of lower right-hand corner there that you see. But what else do we know about him? Well, he's included in all four lists, just like the others. In the list, though, his name shows up as Bartholomew. Now, I call him Nathanael. That's the name that we mostly remember him by because John's the one who talks about him. But he's Bartholomew in those lists. But Bartholomew is a last name. It means son of Ptolemy. And so he was probably Nathanael, son of Ptolemy. Remember how Philip introduced Jesus when he was talking to Nathanael as Jesus, son of Joseph? Okay, well, he was probably Nathanael, son of Ptolemy. John, the first chapter. Let's go back there again. And this is the only reference that we have of Nathanael. And there's a couple of interesting things there that I think we can pull out as well. So in John 1, beginning there in verse 43, it says that the next day he purposed to go into Galilee. He found Philip, and Jesus said to him, "Follow me." Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. And Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom the Moses and the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." And Nathanael said to him, "Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" Philip said, "Come and see." And Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and said of him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed in whom there is no deceit." Nathanael said to him, "How do you know me?" And Jesus answered and said to him, "Before Philip called you, you were under the fig tree, I saw you." And Nathanael answered him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." And Jesus answered and said to him, "Because I said to you that I saw you under the fig tree, you believe? You'll see much greater things than these." And he said to him, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you will see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." Now, think about that exchange for a minute. I think Nathanael was a very plain-spoken person. And we know some people who will always speak their mind. But a lot of times when people speak their mind, what they're really doing is, yeah, it's not the right way to speak your mind, right? We just won't go any further than that. But notice how Jesus addresses Nathanael. He says, behold, here's an Israelite in whom, the King James says, there's no guile. New American Standard says, no deceit. That word could also be translated as treachery. None. An innocent heart. And so when Nathanael says, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? I don't think he's being prejudiced there. I think what he's referring to is Nazareth had a pretty lousy reputation. They had a reputation as not being the most honest folks in the world when it came to doing trade. They had a reputation of being kind of a backwater city. I mean, why do you think Jesus was kind of looked at funny coming out of Nazareth? Because people like Nathanael had that opinion. It's like, can any good thing come out of there? Now, when Philip said, come and see, Nathanael could have easily said, oh, it's not worth it. Nothing good can come out of Nazareth, right? But that's not what he did. He went, okay. And so he comes to Jesus. Jesus sees him going, and he makes this statement, behold an Israelite in whom there is no guile. Now, part of Nathanael's, I think, wonder here is that I think that he realized and worked hard at not having any guile. You see, I think that also points to his spiritual nature. And there's another clue here, because when Nathanael says, how do you know me? This, I saw you under the fig tree. There's an interesting piece about that. Fig trees were very common in that part of the world, but they were a very favored plant because they can grow pretty large and their leaves can spread very nicely, and they make great shade trees as well. And so it's very common for people, especially poor people who had small houses, to plant a fig tree close by the front door that would grow up, because it kind of almost made an extra summer room for free, right? Because when it's hot outside and the shade is covering that area, you can come out and be kind of outside, but under your fig tree. And in the Talmud, there are a couple of references to that that indicate that that was a place of prayer, a place of study, and a place of meditation, is that people would spend some time under the fig tree. In the Old Testament, you will see the prophets talking about, remember when they were talking about the blessings that would come upon them? And it talks about in Zechariah and in Amos and a couple of other places that every man would be under his own vine and under his own fig tree. Again, that expression of a place of security, of prayer, of meditation, of a blessing. And so when Jesus says, I saw you under the fig tree, he's not just saying, oh, I just happened to walk by and there you were. He is giving notice to the fact that Nathanael had a spiritual nature. That Nathanael was willing and eager to think about God. Because how long did it take after that for Nathanael to go, my Lord? It was instant. And in fact, we think of when Jesus said, who do men say that I am? And then he said, who do you say that I am? And we're all familiar with Peter's response, right? You are the Christ, the Son of the living God? Nathanael beat him to it. He was the first one to say it. Right here. Before Jesus had even started performing his miracles. This is before Cana. And so I think we see someone here who was spiritually minded, who may not have had all of the facts in front of him, but when he was confronted with Jesus, made up his mind and became a disciple and followed him after that. Now, we don't have anything else on Philip other than we get to John, the 21st chapter, I mean Nathanael, John 21, verses 1 to 3, a very brief mention. And I only bring this one up as a little artifact that's, I don't know, to me just kind of interesting. As you're studying these people and you start looking at them and saying, where do they show up and what are they doing? This is after Jesus had risen from the dead and he'd appeared a couple of times to his disciples, but the disciples are kind of, they don't know what to do. They're kind of lost without their Lord. And here, after these things, Jesus manifested himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. And he manifested himself in this way. Now, Simon Peter and Thomas, called Didymus, and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee and two others of his disciples were together. And Simon Peter said, I'm going fishing. And they said to him, we'll come with you. They weren't sure what to do. They're kind of at loose ends. And Peter's the natural leader, right? So what does Peter say? let's go fishing. Now, this wasn't the recreational, I got my fly rod, I'm going to go, you know, throw things a few times. This was their livelihood. Peter's basically saying, I can't just sit around here and do nothing. Let's go work. And Nathaniel's one of the ones that said, sure, I'll go with you. Probably says he might have been in the fisherman trade as well. So we have a lot of the disciples that were fishermen. But they went back to work only briefly, because it wasn't long after that that they were gathered on the Mount of Olives to watch him go, and their lives were going to change again. So hopefully that helps. A lot of history behind him as well. Eusebius has the following statement. Pantheus was one of these and is said to have gone to India. It is reported that among persons who knew of Christ, he found the gospel according to Matthew, which had anticipated his own arrival. For Bartholomew, one of the apostles, had preached to them and left them with the writing of Matthew in the Hebrew language, which they had preserved until that time. So the story is that Bartholomew went off into India and preached. And about all he had with him writing-wise was the book of Matthew, but he left that behind. And as centuries went on, people who went back there found out that they were Christians, and there were those following from the work that he had done in that place. The symbol of Bartholomew is pretty bad. You don't find it very much because it's typically an open book referring to the fact that he took the book of Matthew with him with a flaying knife, because tradition says that when he ran foul of some officials that didn't like him, that they flayed him alive and then crucified him. So just to remember his death, they used the flaying knife on there. So not a great symbol, but when you see that, and you see it occasionally, then what they're looking at is remembering that this man died for his Lord, the visionary. I hope that helps bring a couple of people alive. Maybe some things to think about. You may have your own picture when you read those, and that's okay. The main thing is to think about these people and understand they were just people. They started out no different than we are. Differences in socioeconomic status, differences in abilities and in talents that we have. And every one of them found a place and found a way to be of service to God. And so everyone here can too. There's a place for everybody. These 12 are great as an example for that. Next week, we're going to talk about two who are really unlikely to have sat down at the same dinner table. And I'll let you figure out who those two are, and then we'll talk about them next week. If you're not a member of the Lord's body, we invite you to please think about it. Think about the fact that you, as a normal person, can serve your Lord and Master. If you have something you need to make right, we offer you this opportunity to do it. Please come. All together we stand and we sing.